Welcome to the Architectural History Podcast, a podcast dealing with histories of architecture in the built environment. In our first series, Architecture And, we speak to a number of academics, architects, writers and thinkers to discuss space, buildings and cities, and to think through contemporary debates and issues.
Hello.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, Jess. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited for Architecture and Protest.
Yeah, absolutely. So I pulled this one together and I thought after what has been a very important couple of years for political protest in the public eye, it would be good to bring together researchers, activists, historians, thinkers who could comment a little bit about how histories of architecture and of public space and the built environment can be combined with histories of public protest, political protest, people trying to change society, and the ways in which architecture and the built environment can be used as part of those struggles. It felt like a relevant thing to talk about.
Absolutely.
So I guess without further ado, we're joined on this episode by Dr. Adam Elliott Cooper, who's a researcher in sociology based at the University of Greenwich, who works on questions around racial justice and police violence. We're also joined by Katrina Navakas, who is a historian and a reader in history at the University of Hertfordshire, who works on the history of political protest and public space. We're joined by Hannah Alcock, who works as a geographer in the realm of public protest in London. And lastly, we're joined by Morgan Trolland, who's a civil engineer who has done work designing protest structures for Extinction Rebellion. So first, we're going to be joined by Adam, who's going to be talking about the interconnections between place, space, and political protests against racialized violence in London, mostly, or in Britain, certainly, from the sort of post-war era onwards.
So for me, space and place is a really important way of thinking through both racism and anti-racism. So to better understand how space and place plays a really important role in racism, it might be useful to not think about British racism here in Britain, but maybe more useful to think about British racism in its colonies, and to think about how people who migrated to Britain in significant numbers in the post-war period experienced British racism through space and place. So for instance, people who might have grown up in the Caribbean, they would have experienced British racism but through who owned the mines, who owned the factories, who owned the agricultural spaces where they might have grown and cultivated different cash crops such as bananas or sugarcane, for instance. And identifying how not only were these industries owned by British people or the British Empire, but also the places where British people lived, white people lived, would be in specific places in these colonies. They would be high up in the hills with large areas, with large gates around them, with large pieces of luxurious land with beautiful views across the island, whereas where the poorer people lived either in the urban centres where they were living in relatively poorly built shack settlements, or in the rural environments where the rural poor lived and worked in agricultural spaces. And so when we think about people migrating to Britain in significant numbers from its colonies in the post-war period, the so-called Windrush generation, for many of them, coming to Britain wouldn't have been the first time they'd experienced racism. They would have had that experience of racism in Britain's colonies, of being exploited by the British Empire, of being policed by the British Empire, of having the judicial and state systems of state power controlled by Britain, and it reproducing forms of racial hierarchy and racist exploitation and racial violence in that context. And so coming to Britain in the 1940s and 50s, we see a different kind of racism being experienced and being resisted. We see things like the colour bar, which was legal in Britain until the first Race Relations Act. We see experiences of racial violence on the streets, and we see police raids on the homes and businesses of black communities as well.
Yeah, and I suppose from the perspective of place and space, very often migrant communities were settling in specific neighbourhoods in London. There was a process by which those communities joined together and formed together within specific places and specific parts of the built environment.
of the capital and of other British cities. Did that contribute to that process of forming the strands of political solidarity within those communities?
I think there are two or three things here that are really crucial about what areas of the city were accessible to people and what areas weren't. So during the 1940s and 50s, when Britain had its informal colour bar, where no dogs, no blacks, no Irish could be put into the windows of properties which were up for rent or for sale, where dances, clubs, pubs could have a colour bar and refuse to serve people based on their race or ethnicity. We begin to see resistance to this through both the what are called partners, which is where every month a group of maybe five, six or more people will put a certain amount of money into a pot. And every month, one person from the group gets to have all of the money in that pot to put down a deposit for a home in order to purchase a property, because it was difficult for black people to rent in certain parts of cities like London in the 1940s and 50s. But we also see it in kind of social spaces as well, probably perhaps most famously in the No Colour Bar dances, which took place in Brixton in the mid-1950s. So a number of Caribbean people who set up the first Caribbean clubs and sound systems in London were based in Brixton at this time, but they were being banned from a lot of the clubs and from going to dances because of this colour bar. So with the support of a Jewish socialist mayor of Lambeth in the mid-1950s, a guy called Nathan Marrock, they set up what was called the No Colour Bar Dance, which was in what is now Lambeth Town Hall in Brixton. And it was in these spaces that they were able to break down this informal colour bar, and both black and white people were able to enjoy music and dance and drink together. And so it was the resistance of these kind of social as well as these residential spaces that we again see not only attempts to reimpose the kinds of racial divisions that Britain had established in its colonies, but also crucially resistance to these racial divisions as well.
And obviously we're talking there about the 1950s, but protest and acts of resistance within migrant communities against racism, against things like the colour bar, continues all the way through up to the present day. How do you see those movements over that longer period interacting with their built environment and with spaces and with places in tackling these questions of racial injustice?
I think one of the really crucial ones, which I guess links to what we were talking about a moment ago with the No Colour Bar dances, are maybe commercial or community spaces. Places like the Mangrove restaurants in the West End of London, which was referred to as a resting place in Babylon, a Trinidadian run restaurant where both people from Britain's Black Power movements and other radical organisations, as well as local and other Caribbean people generally, were able to eat and drink and play music, and as well as engage in political organising. And this was a really important target for the police to disrupt this kind of anti-racist organising and to frame restaurants like the Mangroves as being hotbeds of criminality and illicit drug use and sex work and other kinds of purportedly deviant activities. And so out of this specific space in the West End of London, we see a resistance movement emerging, not simply a place of organising, but also a place of defending this space, defending this building from these incursions from the state. And it was, I guess, this story has been popularised by a recent television adaptation by Steve McQueen called Small Axe, if people want to learn a little bit more about it. But we see this as a really central, I think, point for these kinds of resistance.
I wonder whether we could talk a little bit about those very famous riots of the 1980s, again, in the context of the built environment in which they took place. Obviously, that they're happening in these black communities that have been subject to racism, to police discrimination, to prolonged campaigns of terrorism at the hands of the state. How do they come out of that place? How are they a product of that place and of that built environment?
There's a really great book by a guy called Stuart Hall and some other of his colleagues called Policing the Crisis. Well, what they identify is the fact that in the 1970s, there are multiple crises in Britain. There's an economic crisis from the oil shocks and leading to a recession. But there are also other crises as well. And one of the most important ones is Britain's kind of national crisis, its loss of empire and its loss of identity. And what Stuart Hall and his colleagues say in that book is that rather than the British government being able to ameliorate this crisis of capitalism by providing people with decent jobs and employment and, you know, and all those other things, they're not able to do that, or they're not willing to do that. And therefore, they instead conjure up a different crisis, a crisis of law and order. And this law and order crisis centres around this category of crime called mugging. It's a term that I'm sure we're all familiar with today. But in the 1970s, it was a very new term, a term actually borrowed from the United States. And crucially, mugging in and itself is not a crime. It's a category of crime. And what a new category of crime enables you to do is to kind of vacuum up lots of existing crimes like theft or robbery or assault into this new category of crime, creating the impression that there is a specifically new problem, that there is a specifically different problem. And if there is a new and different problem, it can be attributed to a new and different people. And it was the black inner city areas of places like London and Bristol, but also Liverpool and Manchester, Moss Side and Toxteth respectively, that you begin to see this moral panic around mugging becoming popular among the press and politicians, but also crucially the police. And so it's in these areas of the United Kingdom, Toxteth or Liverpool 8 in Liverpool, Moss Side in Manchester, St Paul's in Bristol, Chapel Town in Leeds, Handsworth in Birmingham, as well as multiple places across London, that you see a massive increase in stops and searches and arrests and assaults, particularly upon young black people. And so what we see following that are, of course, a series of rebellions that you've already alluded to. But I think what's crucial what I'm really interested in are the kind of more formalized defense campaigns that arise following these rebellions. The Toxteth defense campaign, the Moss Side defense campaign, the Handsworth defense campaign, the Brixton defense campaign. And these defense campaigns are more formally organized initiatives which seek to defend young people from both the arrests and the incarcerations that lead from the rebellions, but also to defend community spaces, youth clubs, restaurants, bars, cafes, all of these different forms of black community infrastructure which are undergoing assault from the police during this period.
And can we talk a little bit about strategy there? What does it actually look like to defend community spaces from state violence? How does that process of organisation happen, and what do they do? What is the actual process there?
Maybe let's move a little bit forward to 1985 for an example of what that kind of defence might look like. So in 1985, there are two shootings, police shootings of black mothers. First, Cherry Gross, who is shot by the police and paralysed, and then Cynthia Jarrett, who is subjected to a home raid, and during that home raid dies in what are to be, to put it lightly, suspicious circumstances, leads to, I guess, two or three different types of community defence. The first is a very physical form of community defence. So in Broadwater Farm, the police try to come onto the estate where the young people are having a protest, and they physically do not allow them to come onto that estate. And the way that Broadwater Farm is built is really interesting. So it's a number of different large blocks, but they're connected by sky walkways. Right. So when they were built, it was considered to be something quite futuristic, that you can move from one block on the estate to another without having to set foot on the ground. But what it also means is that if you know the geography of that estate, it's actually perfect for what we might call an insurrection, right? For an insurgency, because you're able to defend this estate and escape from the police, and making it far more difficult for them to catch you because of the intricacies of that particular complex. And so people built barricades, as in Cable Street and many other protests, and were able to battle the police in these particular contexts. But what's also crucial is that, particularly following Broadwater Farm, and we see a third death after Cherry Gross and Cynthia Jarrett, which is the death of a police officer after those particular rebellions. And it's after that that the police make mass arrests on the young people who live on the estate, going into schools, arresting children straight out of their classrooms, taking them straight to prison. We see a number of people being assaulted, and a large number of people being wrongly accused of killing this police officer. And we know that they were wrongly accused because eventually all of those convictions are overturned following a massive campaign by the Broadwater Farm defence campaign. And it was found that these confessions were signed under duress. Effectively, they were beaten up until they signed a confession. And so we see legal campaigns, we see media campaigns, we see public awareness campaigns being a really central part of the Broadwater Farm defence campaign in this particular context. And so for me, it's really important to think about how these two forms of defence campaigns coalesce. These more spontaneous rebellions, which require kind of physical defence, and these more formalised organising defence campaigns, which make use of legal mechanisms, the press, the courtroom of public opinion, and all of these more, perhaps more easily recognisably, forms of political protest as well.
With the mention of Cherry Gross, I think of the memorial that's been unveiled to her relatively recently, designed by Sir David Adjaye in Windrush Square in the middle of Brixton, which is this very striking piece of memorialization of that attack.
Yes, it is. And if you go to Hornsey Police Station, they have there in there a glass case of a brick that was thrown at them during the Broadwater Farm Rebellions in 1985, but a slightly more private memorialization they've got.
On the subject of memorialization and campaigns for racial justice and their relationship to the built environment, it would be remiss of me not to ask a little bit about where you see protests for Black Lives Matter, and specifically the throwing of the statue of Edward Colston into the river in Bristol, in the context of this longer history of resistance, of defence, of community action, and of symbolic protest action. It fits into this history in a certain way, doesn't it?
I think the statue of Edward Colston, and I'm sure most listeners are aware of who Edward Colston is, which is, I think, a really interesting point as well, because everyone says that these people are trying to destroy history, yet no one would probably know who Edward Colston was if it wasn't for this the destruction of this particular statue. But of course, it also speaks to what we were talking about right at the start of this conversation about racism, that British racism didn't begin on the British mainland. It began in Britain's colonies, and forcing Britain to confront that history of empire and therefore that history of racism is something that can be done by activists as well as by researchers, by targeting these monuments of empire, right? The statues of people like Colston or Cecil Rhodes or even Winston Churchill, right? By thinking about the ways in which they represent that history of empire and its legacies. And I think that targeting that statue, making sure that everyone in the country knows what that person represents and therefore what that history of Bristol is, and then also, of course, what the history of Britain means, I think is a really powerful way of identifying the fact that racism is as British as racism is American, despite the fact that very often our political pundits like to present that it's exclusively an American problem and something that only came to Britain in the post-war period as Black people came to the British mainland in significant numbers, rather than actually something that Britain exported to the world for two or three centuries before the Windrush migration of the post-war period.
That was amazing to hear Adam talk about the sort of long history of these issues, and like you say, the sort of spanning right back from empire and colonies into the Broadwater Farm protests. And I was fascinated by Adam painting this picture of the different strategies between resistance and defence, and the importance of kind of community organising and protecting communities as much as kind of wanting to resist an external force or policing. It was really, really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Adam's work speaks very keenly to the way in which we can start to connect these histories of marginalised communities to the way that we write histories of the built environment. Next, we're going to be talking to Dr. Katrina Navikas, who is a historian of political protest and public space in Britain. And in this part, we talked about the way that radical political movements in the 19th century, who were fighting for more democratic accountability in government, would use the built environment as a tool in their struggle, and also the ways in which they actually acted as architectural patrons themselves.
The rise of the democracy movement is basically what we see in the late 18th century onwards. So new ideas of democracy, one person, one vote, still one man, one vote in this era. And it comes at a time when Britain and other Western countries are urbanising quite rapidly. So it's interesting to see the ways in which these new organisations, these new associations start using the new urban spaces that are built in the late 18th, early 19th century. So some of the early movements, we call them radical movements, but they call themselves various things, build towards this big campaign for one man, one vote, basically. The most famous, biggest movement are the Chartists, who start in the late 1830s. They have a six-point charter, which is demanding the vote. It's also demanding reform of the parliamentary system, which is still quite corrupt and unequal. And the first major, big, organised protest movement in a modern sense. You know, they have committees, they have all different types of protest tactics, they have a newspaper, and they are national across the UK, and their membership is thousands of people, but we also have hundreds of thousands of people turning up to their demonstrations. So they are truly a popular movement.
And you mentioned the new sort of public spaces of British cities that play host to a lot of these large-scale protests. Just for the audience, what kind of spaces are we talking about? What kind of places are we talking about? What do they look like? What do they feel like to be in?
Yeah, so traditionally, if you want a big gathering or a protest in a town, you'd meet in the marketplace. That's the obvious place. That's the centuries-old public space of the town. By the late 18th, early 19th century, civic improvement, as it's called, is the main sort of driver of changes in the urban landscape in the 19th century. So we see much more variety in types of spaces that people can use. So there is a growth in new squares, for example. Particularly the late Georgians love building very geometric grid system. You see that in Newtown in Edinburgh, for example. Palladian townhouses meant to be respectable spaces, but actually they become public spaces because you've got a nice paved square in the middle of them. You also have new types of buildings that can be used for all types of political action. So with civic improvement comes new theatres, new chapels and churches, new town halls. So all of these spaces come into being in this period of civic expansion in the early 19th century, and all types of political movement realise that these are useful spaces for holding meetings and demonstrations. And the whole purpose of protest in this period is to show large support. So you want the largest gathering of people that you can fit in a space. So obviously in a theatre or in a town hall, that's limited by the number of seats you've got. So the Chartists and other groups prefer to have large mass meetings, what they call monster meetings, in open spaces because you can simply fit more people to show, you know, the greater support that your movement have got. So the Chartists choose prominent civic squares where you'd also have different types of civic celebrations, but they also choose their own spaces they want to claim for them. And increasingly, they are restricted from using civic space. They go out and use fields or moorland or waste spaces that aren't paved, that are much more semi-rural, partly because they're out of the city centre where they might get into trouble, but also because they're much larger spaces that they can fit more people in.
Interesting. And is there a sense that there's active strategy here in terms of the way that they use the built environment, in terms of the way these movements are actively trying to leverage this changing built environment and use architecture and the construction of space through buildings in service of their political cause?
Definitely. The Chartists in particular love subverting symbolism. And obviously civic spaces are built with political symbolism in mind. They show the town fathers or the corporation or the mayor and his aldermen their civic amenities. They, you know, the whole point of the 18th, 19th century civic renaissance is to show how great the town is. So the Chartists and other groups, not just the Chartists, but all types of protest groups, like to subvert that. So they claim that space, in they claim the square or they claim the town hall in order to prove the point that they're respectable too. They are deserving of the vote or they're deserving of the cause. They're challenging that local authority and showing that they're citizens of that town as well. And they also subvert the rituals of civic life. So processions through the streets is also a very common form of protest, marching, and they will emulate the kind of civic ritual that you might see on a town's day or on the king's birthday, where the civic elites would process a particular route through the town. And usually it will be from the town hall out to a park or a new square. And again, all of this action is meant to be symbolic. It's meant to be claiming the space. And so the new environment of these new Georgian Victorian city centres enables them to actually play a lot on the symbolism of what power is, in a way that early modern medieval cities had fewer spaces available for them to do that.
I mean, on that question of power, I wonder about the response that these large protests had from the authorities. Tens of thousands of people moving into the large civic spaces of British cities, explicitly calling for radical changes to the way that politics and governance work. How did the powers that be respond to those actions?
Not very well. Democracy is still a bad word in the 1830s, 1840s. It's still associated with revolution, with the French. So most local authorities and magistrates and the police who formed from the 1830s, 1840s are opposing this democratic movement. So there is always a negotiation over the use of space. So usually, actually, the early democratic movements want to be legal. They want to be civic-minded. So they do ask permission of the mayor or the magistrates to use these spaces, because it's usually under the control of the local authorities. And there's quite often a to and fro of requisitions and petitions. Can we use this space? No, you can't. You can go somewhere else. Sometimes the local authorities move them on, but usually these protests are quite heavily policed. They draw up special constables and perhaps block off roads to stop the processions from going particular areas. So it's always a process of negotiation and policing. The most famous big Chartist movement protest that everyone kind of knows about because of a famous photograph is the one at Kennington Common in South London, which happened on the 10th of April, 1848. So it was a time of quite acute concern about the potential for revolution. The French had just had another revolution. So that was an interesting occasion because the authorities let the Chartists have their meeting in Kennington Common, but then they wouldn't let them process to Parliament over the bridges. So they blocked the bridges over the Thames and only allowed a small delegation of the leading Chartists to go to Parliament to make their demands, present their petition. So there was also a distinction made between allowing large groups of people to meet in particular areas and then worry about what happens when they get on the move.
When we're thinking about the history of protest movements in the built environment, we see the city as something built by authorities and kind of controlled by authorities in a certain way. And then the protest movement is something that sort of floods through those channels into that sort of system, that urban system that's established by the authorities. But it's also the case as well that protest movements sometimes actively contribute towards building things, both temporary and permanent structures. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the way that the protest movements themselves can shape and build and contribute to what the built environment is like in cities in the context of protest movements?
Yeah, that's really important. The protest movements have agency. They do things. So with the early democratic movements, and at the start, they didn't have much money. Most of the members are working class, don't have the means to build their own buildings yet, but they use what I call spaces of making do. So they'll hire warehouses or they'll hire the back room of a pub, or they'll use a waste ground. So they're quite creative in their choices of spaces. Sometimes they have sympathetic people like independent ministers of a chapel and who will lend them the spaces as well. So in the early stages, when these movements are still in formation, they make do and mend, they borrow spaces. But by the time the Chartists last from 1836 to the 1850s. So they've got a longevity and they build up enough reserves to start building their own buildings. The other movement that is similar to the Chartists at this point is the Owenite Socialists, and quite often they share the sort of building costs and the organisation of building buildings. So the Chartists and the Socialists in the 1840s build quite a few of their own buildings. In city centres, they build what are called halls of science, which are essentially adult education and early their own universities, basically. They're lecture halls where adults can go and receive education, their libraries. They offer Sunday schools for children. And these are purposely also very symbolic. They look like civic buildings. So the one in Manchester that was built had lettering across the sides of the building, which said sacred to science and things like that. So they're emphasising their education, their rationality, physically on the wording of the building. And quite often they're built in a very sort of classical style as well. At a time when we're moving into the Gothic, we're moving into Victorian Gothic architecture by the 1840s. So perhaps these buildings looked a bit dated, but they certainly wanted to show that kind of link with the classics by using kind of Greek and Roman stylature on the facades of the buildings.
Were they specifically thinking about Greek and Roman society as democratic models? Is that connection being made at the time? Are they thinking about the classical in terms of democratic precedent?
Yeah, the kind of origins of democracy in Greek society, although I think they're aware of the faults of the Roman Empire, but certainly there's that sort of image being portrayed that they are sort of emulating a long tradition of equal rights, essentially. So halls of science are built in many of the industrial cities. So Manchester has one, Huddersfield has one, for example. They also build their own chapels, although some members of the movements are secular, some are Christian. And also there's a great experiment called the land plan, which emerges in the later 1840s, led by Fergus O'Connor, who's one of the main leaders of the Chartist movement. And that's essentially a new town. And they build model villages of quite simple bungalows, 2-3 room bungalows on a plot in Hertfordshire, also in Oxfordshire, where the purpose is to resettle industrial workers onto the land, make them self-sufficient. So they're given a small holding. And these also have a community hall, a chapel, a school, and are meant to be this kind of idealised utopian environment. If you look at the adverts encouraging people to subscribe, they're very picturesque pictures of these lovely bucolic scenes. But oh, they also have the floor plans of the bungalows on them, like a property advert as well. So the land plan wasn't successful in the end. It ran into inevitable financial difficulties, but you can still go and visit the settlements. The one at Minster Lovell in Oxfordshire's National Trust. You can go to Heronsgate in Hertfordshire and still see these modest bungalows, which are now worth millions of pounds because they're in the commuter belt. So the Chartists were quite creative in the types of buildings that they ended up building.
That was so interesting to hear Katrina talk about this subverting of the symbolism of urban spaces in the 19th century. And like you said in the intro, they become patrons of the built environment as well, that protesters are not just necessarily always challenging or subverting or attempting to destroy, but are creating spaces as well. And that idea of the built environment not always being something to react against, but having a kind of positive impact. I mean, Katrina talked about the garden cities that were built as a kind of utopia. But even these small universities, the Halls of Science, which is such a fantastic title, are sort of using architecture and buildings to literally manifest the spaces that you want to see, the change you want to see.
Well, I think there's an interest across all everyone who we're speaking to today in restoring agency to protest movements, to minority groups in the way that we write histories. Because I think in the past, sometimes histories have defaulted to a mode of saying, here's who was in power and here's what they were doing to curtail the ability of people to protest and to enact political change in the public realm. And actually all of these speakers in some sense are interested in the opposite story, in how protest movements had agency and how they used the built environment against hegemonic forces, which is absolutely relevant with our next speaker as well, Hannah Alcock, who's going to be talking a little bit about the Battle of Cable Street in London in the 1930s and community resistance against British Fascist Party marches in predominantly Jewish neighbourhoods.
I think it's probably one of the most famous protests in British history, and it's very important to the kind of history of British anti-fascism. And it's remembered by a lot of activists and protesters today as a very important kind of significant moment in of a rejection of fascism in Britain. So it took place on the 4th of October 1936 in the East End of London. And in the 1930s in London, we had in Europe as a whole, we had economic depression and then fascism kind of spreading throughout Europe. And the British Union of Fascists was founded in 1932. East London at the time was kind of London's industrial heartland. And it was also home to a lot of the city's most deprived communities, as well as a significant proportion of the Jewish population of London at the time. So there'd been several waves of Jewish immigration to London over the last few decades, and about 60% of London's Jewish population lived in the East End. That combination of poverty and groups migrating in can often sadly lead to kind of episodes of xenophobia and violence. So the East End, as well as being this incredibly kind of diverse area, was also one of the strongholds of the British Union of Fascists. And it was one of the areas where they had a lot of support. So in 1936, the British Union Fascists, the BUF, were planning a march to celebrate their fourth anniversary, and they decided to hold it in East London because of how much support they had there. So the plan was to assemble near the Tower of London and then march to four mass meetings across the East End. And obviously the Jewish population in East London were not comfortable with this. The Jewish People's Council Against Fascism organized a petition calling for the march to be banned, but the Home Secretary refused on the grounds of freedom of speech. So the Jewish People's Council Against Fascism were joined by the Independent Labour Party and the Communist Party of Great Britain in organising resistance to the march. So it's kind of celebrated as a moment where you've got different groups, different movements coming together to kind of unite against fascism. So on Sunday, the 4th of October, protesters kind of gathered all around the East End. And by 1:30 p.m., the junction between Whitechapel High Street and Commercial Street at Aldgate was blocked by a mass of people. It's very difficult to estimate the number of people that attend protests, but it was up to 250,000 people took part that day, which is a huge number. To add to that massive crowd of people, there were sympathetic anti-fascist tram drivers that had just kind of abandoned their trams in the middle of Aldgate. They'd taken the steering levers home so nobody else could move them. So the police just weren't able to force a way through for the BUF to march. So they decided to try and get a route through Cable Street instead. So Cable Street was more narrow than Aldgate. It wasn't as suitable for a march because of that, but Aldgate was just, there were just too many people there. But Cable Street actually proved no easier to break through. Protesters had built barricades from all kinds of things, an overturned lorry. They'd levered up paving slabs. There were wooden boards, bricks, pretty much anything they could find from nearby builders' yards, that kind of thing, were used to block Cable Street. And also, because it had houses on both sides, people were throwing missiles out of the windows and off the roofs at police. So things like buckets of water, half-filled glass bottles, which kind of exploded when they hit the ground. So it was actually no easier for the police to find a way through in Cable Street than it was at Aldgate. So in the end, in the sort of late afternoon, the police decided that it wasn't going to be possible for the British Union of Fascists to march. And they had to kind of go in the opposite direction, basically through central London instead. And they ended up on the embankment. So as I said, for some, this is kind of a great victory, a really important moment in the history of British anti-fascism, a kind of moment of unity and a really wonderful event to be celebrated.
Mm. It's interesting there. I didn't know the thing about people going up into the houses next door. This mass fortification by the community of this place. Hanny, you're a geographer by discipline. What do you think geography brings to the kind of historical study? If we're bringing together these studies that consider political protest movements in history and are trying to put them in their spaces that they existed in, trying to really consider them in the context of their built environment, what does geography bring to the field when we're trying to tell these stories?
Geography is, or particularly human geography, is about how people interact with spaces and places around them in a very broad kind of general way, both how societies sort of influence space and place, but also how space and place influence societies. And what I kind of mean by so space and place are concepts, kind of words that we use every day, but geographers spend a lot of time talking about what they actually kind of mean, and so the way that we theorize them gets very complicated. But basically, when we talk about spaces, we're talking about the kind of physical environment around us, whether that's built man-made or kind of natural. And then when we talk about place, we're thinking about those physical spaces plus the meanings and connotations and emotions that we as individuals and as collectives associate with those spaces. So I think that those concepts in particular, and also other geographical concepts that we use quite a lot, things like networks, territory, those kinds of concepts, can be really helpful in sort of thinking about the way that protest and social movements in the past have interacted with the spaces and places around them.
You work on the history of resistance and of political protest. Do you think there's something that we miss out when we're thinking about the history of protest, when we fail to adequately account for space and place and some of these questions about the built environment that you've alluded to there?
Oh, absolutely. I think there has been a tendency in the past to think of space and place as just these kind of 2D sort of backdrops, these kind of empty stages, if you like, that protest happens in. But it's much more complicated than that. It's much more interactive than that. So space, place and architecture, the built environment, they shape which tactics are possible for protesters, for example, and which tactics are likely to be successful. So if we think about the Battle of Cable Street, the protesters were able to build barricades in Cable Street because of how narrow the street was. That was a tactic that wouldn't necessarily have worked in Aldgate, for example, and you know, using the houses to pelt the police with all kinds of missiles and objects and things. So again, that wouldn't have been possible without the built environment being the way that it was. So it's very kind of important, I think, to think about those interactions. Also, in turn, the way that protest shapes spaces and places. So as Katrina talked about, the way that social movements contribute to the built environment, but you can also think about it in the short term as well. So protests can change the built environment in terms of graffiti, and possibly even damage during riots and those kinds of protests, you know, smashed windows, sometimes burnt buildings, that kind of thing. So there's this fascinating relationship between the built environment and protest that I think it's really important that we take into consideration.
And also, I suppose sometimes authorities deliberately reshaping the built environment, making streets wider, making it more difficult for protest movements to maximize those spaces as symbolic ways of getting their message across.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's the kind of famous example of the redevelopment of Paris after the French Revolution, with the streets being made wider to make it harder to protest. I mean, it's actually a bit more complicated than that. But in the modern day as well, you've got, you know, important buildings like embassies, that kind of thing, being designed to minimize the risk of terrorist attacks, for example, which are a very extreme form of protest. But you definitely get kind of authorities and people in power designing spaces in ways that attempt to minimize or kind of shut down resistance.
And Hannah, your work considers the kind of long durée, the full history, the full breadth of the history of protest in Britain. Are there themes that particularly come forward for you? Are there things that repeat themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously there's a lot that's changed in that time period. You know, things like social media and just kind of television, the internet, all those kinds of things have had a big impact on protest movements. But there's other things that you see kind of staying true throughout. This idea of claiming space, of it being very important as a kind of protest movement to make yourself sort of seen and heard in public spaces and in the built environment, is an important part of kind of justifying your cause, showing that your cause has support and that there are, you know, people who kind of agree with you and, you know, yes, you need to pay attention to us because this is a big deal. That's something that kind of rings true throughout history.
So Hannah's talk was so interesting. First of all, somebody from a different discipline, a human geographer, reflecting on architecture and the built environment and how people use it and interact with it and how it can become a tool within strategies of protest. And I thought it was so interesting where you talked about how space and place can shape what's available to people, but that protesters and communities can then impact on that and change that. And I think there were real parallels with Adam's talk about Broadwater Farm and the use of the overhead walkways and barricading them so that the community could take ownership of it. Obviously, then the descriptions of what happened at Cable Street with the communities, but also the communities supported in solidarity by people like tram drivers blocking Whitechapel with their trams. Is such a wonderful image. So yeah, this sort of interaction between humans and space is so interesting.
Well, and also relevant for our last speaker, who's slightly different to the sort of people we've generally had on the podcast so far. His name's Morgan Trolland, and he's a civil engineer who has been involved with the protest movement Extinction Rebellion, specifically designing these very visually striking, high-intensity bamboo structures that appeared all over the front page of various newspapers in 2020, when they were used to blockade the entrances to certain tabloid newspapers' printing presses and stop distribution of certain newspapers as an act of political protest. So I asked him a little bit about the strategies involved and how exactly they came to decide on this method of design and of architectural production as a route for protest.
Well, the system's called tensegrity, invented in the early 60s, and it's kind of a biomimicry structural form. And you have a number of independent solid elements, in this case bamboo poles, and they are hung all independently in a web of tension cables, which gives the kind of fascinating impression that they're just hanging in the air, especially at night when the wires disappear. So it's been described as islands of compression and a sea of tension.
Let's say hypothetically that I'm not very scientifically savvy and I don't really know what that means. There's wires and there's stretches of bamboo. They're pulling against each other. Is that it stands upright through those different pieces pulling in tension against each other?
Yeah, we make assemblies that hold their shape regardless of any like load applied to them, like gravity or a person's weight or wind. So this one of these structures, if it was like floating in zero G or floating in water, would still hold this particular shape because the wires are all pulling against each other, and you always tighten them up a bit to make it nice and taut and stiff.
And I guess part of the appeal and part of the reason that you've been using these structures as part of protests with Extinction Rebellion is the fact that they can be put up very quickly. Are they easy to assemble? How does that process work?
Ha! They're not easy to assemble, and that's half the fun, really. It was never like a given from the beginning that we would figure out how to actually assemble them quickly. Quickly is a relative term. I mean, it's like usually about 10 minutes is a good time for putting these things together. And the media exaggerates our agility by bumping it down to like 7 and 6 minutes I've seen in the media. But yeah, 9 minutes is like really sharp. But it's very easy to get it all tangled and in a stressful mess. So the process of packaging and arranging these things is half the technical problem.
And I guess part of the reason for using them is that once they're constructed, once they're up, because they're under such high tension, and especially if you have someone hanging, suspended inside these tower structures, it's very difficult to take them down safely. You need to know what you're doing. So if police come along, they can't necessarily deconstruct them themselves. Is that part of the logic?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To try and present something that confuses the police so that they have to take plenty of time to work out what they're going to do. Because luckily, when they're dealing with the sort of protests I've been involved with, they have generally operated pretty cautiously and try not to harm anyone. So that means the onus is on them to fully understand exactly what they're dealing with and to work out what the effect of any action they'll take is going to be. Yeah, it's great that they're complicated because that gets us more time to put across the message that the occupying public space is trying to put across.
And I just wanted to ask as well about aesthetics. They are these very striking forms, these big towers, kind of jumbles of sticks almost, and parts of them seem to be hanging, seem to be suspended in the air. Do you think about the aesthetics of protest when you're involved in kind of direct action? Is that something that is considered beforehand around sort of how it's going to look hypothetically with a photograph taken on the front of a newspaper?
That was absolutely a motivation to make 10 integrity structures for protest. The fact that will fascinate people, and you'll get even your critics can't stop but look and stare. I mean, the best was the cover of the Telegraph last year after the press blockade, and it said sort of awful, terrible Extinction Rebellion people headline, and then a picture that just said, wow, and just a beautiful full-size front page photograph of our blockade. It's a way to get a message to people who are otherwise going to have their ears closed to what you're trying to say, I think.
And that kind of symbolic power has also caused some issues, right, for working with tensegrity structures in other contexts or in related contexts. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the commission along the Watchtower for Anti-Pavilion?
Yes, certainly, because me and my friends at Flint to make these things, you know, have so much fun doing it. We just looked at more opportunities to apply this kind of structural system and to push the envelope into different geometries and interesting shapes. And so we saw this anti-pavilion competition, which is an annual competition for an architecture curiosity on the roof of this building in Hackney by the canal. Really beautiful sight. And so we came up with a tensegrity, bamboo tensegrity pavilion. We call it the Watchtower. And it was so much fun to design, because we could go beyond just the standard little towers that we did, because this time we could do something that didn't have to be erected quickly. We could take our time at it because it's a legitimate private property. Well, so we thought. So, we get commissioned by the Anti-Pavilion this year and get a large group of volunteers from across the neighborhood and my personal network and friends and da-da-da. And we make this big structure, call it All Along the Watchtower. And about 4 days after it's completed, the Metropolitan Police send a huge raiding party to batter down, like destroy every door in this studio complex and smash into adjacent apartments, arresting people in their homes. Just horrible, really horrible stuff, really traumatic, awful thing for people who've been put through. And this police raid and all the destructive door smashing was aimed at seizing this bamboo structure that they thought was going to be used for some kind of Extinction Rebellion activity. And in the second day of their occupation, the police, with all their height removal specialists and trucks and kit, all sort of scratched their head and gave up, because they could see that it was going to be days of work for them to remove it. And I think they were questioning why on earth they'd gone there in the first place.
So what is going to be the fate of them? Are they being taken down, or are they...
Well, no, it's still there. I just saw it this morning. We're looking to continue to enjoy this art installation and have a celebration for all the people that got together to make it, and celebrate the fact that the police couldn't take it away off us.
That's so great to hear that story of the backstory behind the design and the making of those structures, and then their life story through the Anti-Pavilion. And I thought it was really interesting to hear Morgan talk about the conscious choices that they made as designers around the style and aesthetic of their protest, and that these structures were built as visually arresting structures as much as needing to sort of have a physical presence and a physical function within the protest, that relationship between aesthetic and function. It was really interesting to hear him talk about that. And again, I think it echoes with some other things. You know, you mentioned Haussmann and the redesign of Paris. Katrina was talking about the symbolism of kind of social reform architecture in the 19th century. And actually, It just made me think that sometimes style is important for kind of communicating the idea behind what's going on, or even grabbing attention. You know, the point of those Extinction Rebellion structures was to draw attention as well.
Yeah, I think when I asked that question of Morgan about aesthetics, I was thinking in a lot of ways about the very image-rich culture that we live in, whether it's photographs on the front of newspapers or indeed on social media, and like the virality of the image. But the reality is that protest movements have always been concerned with symbols, with the ability to visually arrest attention. While that's taken a specific form in the kind of attention economy of 21st century social media, it's always been true that political protest movements have been concerned with creating arresting images that can unite or break through the sort of noise of day-to-day life, be it like, you know, the treacle or you know, it's always been a part, that aesthetic mission has always been a part of successful protest movements, which is very interesting to think about from a design perspective.
Absolutely. And you said there about virality, the shareability, the social media, and we were talking at the beginning before we started recording about what's so interesting about this episode is everyone talking about the physicality of protest and the spaces of it, and how that runs counter to so many narratives that there are now about, you know, clicktivism and social media having taken the sting out of protest, I suppose. And I think it was interesting not only to see the history of it, but to hear Morgan talk about the sort of very contemporary issues of space that still are really important in social activism and protest.
I think very, very interesting threads following through all of those different periods, actually. Well, that's it, I suppose. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a review in your podcast app because it helps other people to find us. And make sure you subscribe. We've got a couple more episodes in this series coming down the pipeline.
We've got Architecture and Energy coming up and hopefully something on architecture and living in the city.
Brilliant. And also, if you've enjoyed these podcasts, you will almost certainly enjoy becoming a member of the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain. There will be a link in the show notes. It's a very, very brilliant community and organisation of people working around questions of architectural history. So do become a member through the link and you'll be able to access lots of other things, including this podcast, but, you know, support the work of the society.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. This podcast has been produced by the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain, SAHGB. Established in 1956, we're the leading subject association for architectural history in the United Kingdom. Our educational mission is to promote architectural history inclusively to diverse audiences. Our mantra is all places, all periods, all welcome. We promote knowledge through learning, education, and research. We disseminate that knowledge through programming, content, and publications, and we advocate for the discipline and our members. To find out more about our work and to support our educational mission, please visit our website, sahgb.org.uk, or follow us at the SAHGB on Twitter or on Facebook. We are open to all. This podcast series has been created by Jessica Kelly, Matthew Lloyd Roberts, and Neil Sashore. The series is produced by Frontier. To find out more about them, visit frontierpodcasts.com.